This, as you know, is the review of our interim results for the 24 weeks ended the 28th of February 2015. The format today is largely unchanged, so I will go through the financial highlights and business highlights first before handing over to John. John will go through the income statement, the balance sheet, the tax line. He'll spend rather more time on currency today than on previous occasions before going through the segmental analysis and then handing back to me to go through the business sector by sector. So the financial highlights of these, and you may well have seen them, group revenue £6.248 billion, adjusted operating profit £474 million for the half, adjusted profit before tax £450 million, adjusted earnings per share 46.1. The board has declared an interim dividend up 3% to 10, and net debt at the half year stands at £801 million after capital expenditure of £277 million. The business highlights are these. Primark continues to grow strongly, both in sales and also in footage. Significant profit progress at Ingredients and Agriculture, and further margin improvement in our grocery portfolio. So much of the group really is in rude good health. Sugar, the much flagged lower EU prices have obviously have obviously had an impact on our profitability. The cost improvement programs, which are so important for our long-term sustainability, are coming through well, and I will come back to them in a little while. Looking ahead, then, currency is an issue for it. We have to assume, I think, that these new currency pairs remain in place, and we will have to deal with the consequences of those currency rates. We have to, and we will. So, John, over to you.
Thanks, George. Good morning, everyone. So, looking at the income statement, revenue of £6.2 billion was 1% higher than the first half last year. As George has said, I'll be making a more detailed reference to currencies in a few moments, but the effect in this period was more limited. Sterling strengthened against most of our trading currencies, with the notable exception of the US dollar, and this reduced the value of overseas revenues when translated back into sterling. When compared at constant currency, revenue was 3% ahead. Adjusted operating profit, which excludes the amortization of non-operating intangibles, profit on the sale of fixed assets, and the exceptional item, fell by 5% to £474 million. But adjusted for the effect of currency movements on translation of £11 million in the half year, it was only 2% behind. As usual, I've included a table of average and period-end exchange rates at the end of your slide pack. As already announced, the exceptional charge of £98 million is for the non-cash impairment of the group's shareholder loans to Vivergo Fuels, our wheat-fed bioethanol joint venture. Following the recent fall in crude oil prices, and especially bioethanol prices, we reported this to the market at the beginning of February alongside our major partner in the joint venture, BP. Unadjusted operating profit after bearing this exceptional charge was 24% lower at £353 million. You will be aware of our decision to withdraw from beet sugar operations in Heilongjiang, China, in the northeast. We expected the loss on closure of the two factories at Yi'an and Bocheng to be £128 million. But since then, we've sold the Yi'an factory and have revised our estimate of the loss on sale and closure to £116 million. Discussions for the sale of the Bocheng factory are continuing, and if successful, we expect a further marginal reduction in the loss. And importantly, there'll be virtually no cash costs. Net interest expense reduced from £29 to £26 million as a result of a lower level of average net borrowings compared with the same period last year. Profit before tax at £213 million was 51% lower than last year, mostly reflecting the two one-off charges. On our adjusted basis, profit before tax was 4% lower at £450 million. On tax, I indicated at the full year results present announcement in November that the tax rate would fall. The underlying tax rate applied in this year's interim results is 21.3%, compared with 23.5% reported for the prior period. This reduction mainly reflects the lower UK corporation tax rate applicable in the current year and a higher proportion of profit earned in territories with lower tax rates. The underlying charge is used in the calculation of adjusted earnings. Two items give rise to a difference between this underlying charge and the reported charge. There's a tax credit of £4 million on the amortisation of certain non-operating intangible assets, which arose on acquisitions in prior years. A number of these intangibles are now fully amortised, and hence the size of this credit has reduced. And secondly, a credit of £3 million on the one-off items for the Vivergo impairment and the withdrawal from Heilongjiang. This is smaller than you might expect. The group has already had the benefit of tax relief on Vivergo's trading losses to date, which restricts the amount of relief available on this impairment charge, and the group is unable to utilise the tax loss created on the sale and closure of the sugar factories. This causes the reported tax rate on the unadjusted profit before tax to rise to 41.8%. Adjusted earnings per share were 1% ahead of last year at 46.1 pence, benefiting from lower interest charges, the lower tax rate, and lower minority interests. Unadjusted earnings per share were lower at 18.1 pence. The board has declared an interim dividend of 10 pence per share, an increase of 3% on last year, reflecting our confidence and continuing the progressive approach to dividends that we've adopted for some years now. Turning now to the balance sheet, net assets increased over the last 12 months by £130 million to £6.49 billion, which is net of a loss of £182 million on the translation of overseas net assets. Fixed assets, both intangible and tangible, were little changed, with additions in the period being offset by currency, the impairment charges taken this period, and amortisation or depreciation charged. Working capital increased by £107 million. I made reference at this time last year to the lower than expected level of working capital. In particular, Primark had very low stock levels in Spain after exceptional trading. This increase takes into account the growth of Primark and a return to more normal inventory levels. Net debt was a little lower than last year at £801 million and benefited from the strong cash flow in the second half of last year, offset by acquisition expenditure and translation on our US dollar term debt. Although our bank debt is reducing, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that a new accounting standard for leasing is expected later this year. This will add lease obligations, together with related right-of-use assets, to the balance sheet, and these will be significant for us as we take account of Primark's leases. The methodology and time for transition have yet to be announced, but we'll give you more detail when these become clear. The caption here, other net financial assets, has increased significantly and reflects exchange rate movements. The figure comprises two main elements, and let me describe them. The first is the mark-to-market value of the forward currency cover taken out by Primark in its normal course on US dollar price garments to be sold in the second half of this year. The second item relates to currency swaps on some of our term debt from US dollars to euros to match our underlying currency assets more closely. The maturity profile of these swaps is matched to the maturity profile of our private placement debt. And finally, on the balance sheet here, the increase in provisions of 27 million related primarily to the cost reduction initiatives in sugar. So turning to currency, sterling has appreciated against most of our trading currencies. Whereas last year, the major movements were against the currencies of emerging markets, this year we've seen movements against the euro and the US dollar, and it's our working assumption, as George mentioned earlier, that these rates will be with us for some time to come. The weakness of the euro has been particularly pronounced since January, as this chart shows. The dollar has been strengthening for some time now. These movements affect us or affect our results in two ways: translation and transaction. The impact of translation was 11 million in the half year, and if these current rates persist, the effect will be some 25 million in the full year. The move in the US dollar and euro are more significant for their transaction effect, and I'll explain more about this on the next slide. The sugar industry in the EU is mainly contracted in euros, and for British Sugar, which is no exception to that, the exchange rate for invoicing customers is adjusted on a fortnightly basis. With a sterling cost base, margins are reduced by a weakening euro. Primark buys a substantial proportion of its garments in US dollars and, in the ordinary course, takes out forward currency cover when contracts are placed to fix the sterling or euro margin of the garments. Our forward cover, taken out at weaker US dollar exchange rates, runs to August 2015. Garments for the autumn-winter season will be contracted at today's stronger dollar and weaker euro exchange rates. At this stage of the financial year, there are clearly a number of moving parts, and I do want to say that Primark is working to mitigate the effect of these currency movements. This will have some impact on margins this year, but with a full year effect, will have an even greater impact next year. So coming on to cash flow. We saw a return to the normal seasonality for the group with a free cash outflow in the first half. You may remember my comment last year that the cash generation in the first half was unusually high last year. This year's outflow was 80 million. The change was mostly driven by the working capital outflow, with a return to more normal levels at Primark compared with the unusually low level last year. Moving to capital expenditure, the spend in our food businesses was unchanged year on year, and I expect it to reduce a little from this level following completion of the capital investment program in our U.K. bakeries. The pipeline of new stores at Primark is as full as ever, and the reduction in capital expenditure that we see here reflects the phasing of spend. Elsewhere, I have highlighted the dividends received from joint ventures and associates, and I'm pleased with the receipt of a £27 million dividend from our US joint venture, Stratas Foods, following the £9 million received last year. And finally, we completed the acquisition of Dorset Cereals last October at a cash cost of £60 million. The segmental analysis. Primark delivered another strong result, with sales ahead 12% as reported, or 15% at constant currency. The revenue declines in our food businesses were primarily because of food commodity price deflation, particularly in sugar. Profit was well ahead in agriculture, ingredients, and retail, which virtually offset the reduction of 67 million in sugar. Grocery margin increased from 7.4% to 8.1% and followed the improvement that we saw in the second half of last year. The decline of 50 basis points in Primark's margin is, I suspect, in line with your expectations, given the exceptional trading that Primark enjoyed in 2014. Looking at return on capital employed by business, 16.5% at agriculture is becoming very strong, and the recovery to a much more respectable 8% by ingredients is welcome. The decline in the margin and return on capital employed for the group overall reflects the sugar performance. And finally, from me, by geography, British Sugar was the main contributor to the decline in UK revenue and profit, offset in part by Primark. Primark's rapid growth in continental Europe is an increasingly important contributor to the improvement in sales in the Europe and Africa segment, but profit was held back by sugar in Spain. In the Americas, the improvements in revenue, and especially profit, is driven by the US and Mexico, offsetting some weakness in South America, where a few of the countries there face difficult economic circumstances. The revenue decline in Asia Pacific is driven by the weakening of the Australian dollar. In aggregate, the profit of our businesses in China improved, but George Weston Foods was held back by higher meat costs, but we believe that those will improve in the second half. At that point, I'll hand back to George.
John, thank you very much. We turn first then to sugar, where in the EU in particular, trading has been tough, as I think we knew it would be, because of the reduction of EU sugar sales prices. The processing campaigns in both Spain and the UK were exceptionally good. The focus on cost improvement globally continues, and we've seen good cost reductions coming through once more. Last but not least in my highlights, we do expect to make a small profit for the full year against a small loss at the half year. Turning to the operations, really excellent factory performance. We processed a record crop through the four factories. We've never produced 1.45 million tonnes of sugar through four factories. It's the highest production since 2006 when we had six factories. We didn't necessarily want all the sugar, but nonetheless, the teams in those four factories performed magnificently, as did the supply chain to it. In Vivogo, we have achieved the rated output of that very large plant. We're not enjoying the low bioethanol prices at all, and we need the market for ethanol to grow, as we believe it will over the next couple of years, as the mandates for the inclusion of renewables in the fuel system in Europe begin to take effect. In Illovo, we produced 1.76 million tonnes of sugar. Malawi was difficult for a couple of reasons. Prices fell in that market. And, of course, where we export sugar from African countries, either into Europe or onto the world market, we have suffered from those lower prices both in Europe and in the world market. In China, good performances from all the continuing factories. So you'll remember we shut two factories in Heilongjiang province. We have two beet factories still in Hebei and four cane factories in the southwest. All the remaining factories are cash generative, and we do welcome the higher prices we are seeing now in the Chinese sugar market. Turning to prices, first in the EU and then secondly on the world, stage, we, as you see in this chart on the left, a further sharp price fall in the European market, and the impact of lower prices made more significant for us looking forward by euro weakness. British Sugar has a largely sterling cost base, of course. We see quota stocks in Europe reducing, and there is some indication, and I hesitate before being too firm on it, that European prices are stabilizing and in some cases may be beginning to rise somewhat. Turning to the world prices, there is an abundant stock of sugar globally. We've had 4 years of surplus production. I don't think that the world price will move up dramatically anytime soon. A further cause of weakness, of course, is the devaluation of the Brazilian real, which makes their cost of production in dollar terms lower. The cost update, cost performance of the sugar businesses is really important, particularly with deregulation coming. Lowest cost in Europe will be the best place to compete. We've seen once more very good delivery of performance improvement program gains in all our businesses, factory efficiencies, and I think as we flagged in November when we had an exceptional charge, overhead reductions, we're beginning to see good benefit from those overhead reductions. Something like 250 people have come out of the European businesses in the first half of the year. Repeating my point about the closure of the Heilongjiang beet factories, our ability to sell Yi'an we were grateful for it. And as I said before, all the remaining factories are cash generative, even before these prices began to rise somewhat. The largest element of cost in our sugar businesses is the raw material, either sugar beet or cane. The price of cane was lowered in China this year, and we welcome that as well. It has contributed to the cash generation in the cane businesses. And next year, we will see UK beet prices and Spanish beet prices come down, in both cases, by around 20%. Those are very significant reductions and will contribute to improvements next year, we expect. If I can move on then to our agricultural portfolio, where we saw a 21% increase in operating profit. This business is now an important contributor to the total level of profitability of the group, and also an even stronger contributor to the growth of the group. Once more, in the commodity part of the business in the UK, cash margins were maintained in a falling market. That is no small effort. We have two specialty businesses, Vista, which we've talked about in the past, and Quantum Blue, you may remember. Just a couple of statistics. The first one about Vista, one in five of the world's chickens contains product produced by Vista. It's a very significant, I think that's 70 billion chickens that are consumed globally a year, one in five of them have some of our product. Specialty nutrition is a second specialty part of our animal feed business. It's got various areas of expertise, particularly around the feeding of baby pigs, not only in the UK, but also through Europe. And then secondly, in pet nutrition, 8 out of 10 pet food products, and there's a number from the past, contain a specialty nutrition ingredient. Finally, in the agricultural business, our China feed business has performed well. Both it and specialty nutrition are now led by young and very capable management teams, and I congratulate actually everyone in agriculture for another super performance. Moving on to the grocery portfolio, once again, strong profit growth at Twinings Ovaltine, but also very good profit growth at ACH in North America. Food commodity price deflation is something that we've had to cope with, and as we've had to cope with intense competition in the bread markets in both Australia and the UK. Further margin improvement, though, across the whole of the portfolio, even as sales have come down a little bit, with that's the deflation effect. And then last but not least, Dorset Cereals was acquired in the period, and the integration of that is well underway. It's a super brand to have as part of the ABF and grocery portfolio. Focusing on Twinings Ovaltine, once more record market shares in both the UK and Australia, and it's an important, although this is a business where the front end, where the sales and marketing are so important, the supply chain can never be ignored, and we've seen cost release from the supply chain and both brands, and that funds investment in brand. Back in November, we mentioned the restaging, the repackaging, and the reformatting of both green and fruit infusions, green tea and fruit infusions in the UK. We have relaunched, restaged black tea in the first half to great effect. New packaging, new products, new formats, and last but not least, new advertising. Moving on in grocery, Jordan's Ryvita, Dorset is trading very well. The integration is actually ahead of plan, and as I say, we're excited about that. Jordan's brand itself has grown very well over the last really 18 months, and it's worth flagging that, both in the UK but also internationally, Canada and Australia in particular, good listings and good rates of sale in Australia. Finally, within Jordan's Ryvita Thins, the manufacturer of which we took in-house now about 18 months ago, they continue to grow very, very strongly. The capital investment program in Allied Bakeries is now complete. Stevenage was the last plant, and it commissioned fully in December. We now have the network of lowest cost bakeries in the country, and are capable of making very high quality bread. Where in this era of intense competition, having that low cost base is absolutely vital, and we have it. Despite some losses, which have been well flagged both in the newspapers and elsewhere, we have maintained bread volumes, and we will continue to do so. We did see lower profit in Allied Bakeries, though, as a consequence of the competition. In Australia, we set out to reset the price of branded bread. The gap between own label and brand had got too big. We've brought down the prices of branded bread. The market share of brands is now increasing. There was, of course, an investment, a cost of doing that, but I think it's absolutely been the right thing to do. Don KRC, the other large part of George Weston Foods, saw nicely increased volumes, good improvements, further improvements in factory efficiencies. They were held back in the first half by higher meat costs, which reflects supply difficulties in the States. Those supply difficulties have come to an end, and the higher costs, as John said, are falling away. Finally, on grocery in the States with ACH and also Stratus, which is worth mentioning, we've seen a good volume growth at Mazola on the back of the continuing success of the Plant Sterile campaign. That campaign, I think, will run and run and run. And we also undoubtedly benefited from lower corn oil costs in America. Capullo is building share and margin in Mexico. And then finally, we're absolutely delighted with the performance of Stratus, the joint venture with ADM. I think John flagged earlier that we'd received two dividends from that business. It's in a very, very different place to where it was when we entered into the joint venture, when we've created the joint venture a few years ago. Our ingredients businesses, the strong improvement continues, up in constant currency terms 87% in the first half. In Maori, yeast and bakery ingredients, both were ahead in margin and in volume. The supply chain improvements, which are a part of the turnaround, they continue. We also bought and integrated a small European bakery business, and that integration has gone extremely well. In ABF Ingredients, the specialty part of the portfolio, we saw excellent sales and profit growth really across that business, enzymes in particular, but it's unfair just to single them out. We believe that the improvement both in Mowry and also in ABFI will continue into the future. Think it's got some way to run. Retail then, strong trading in the first half, sales up 15% in constant currency terms, 11% increase in retail selling space, some 500,000 square feet of new stores. Those new stores all trading above the average of the whole, and that is a very, very good sign for us. The US launch preparations have been intense and but are well advanced now. Like-for-like sales in the period level, the picture is actually a whole lot better than that, and I'll come back to like-for-likes later on. Turning first to trading, though, we had a very strong Christmas that recovered the situation that we were left with after a warm autumn that many in the trade have remarked upon. UK like-for-likes were positive, good sales growth in the UK. Spain, Portugal and Ireland were all very strong throughout the first half. We saw strong market shares gains in our two biggest markets, being the UK and Iberia. But we did see a modest increase in markdown. The warm autumn was part of the reason. The other part of the reason was the low level of stock we were running with in Iberia in the first half last year, particularly after the spectacular opening of the French market, which sucked stock out of Spain. So we got back to a more normal level of stock and therefore a more normal level of markdown in Iberia. Primark is all about the clothes that we sell. Here are examples of spring-summer merchandise. The bohemian look is very big. It's very easy to access. A lot of ways of buying into the trend. Bracelets, rings, of course, as well as dresses, belts, floppy hats, etc., etc. In menswear, if you're not wearing brightly coloured board shorts yet, you either will be soon or you should be. Another important area of focus of the teams has been denim. Great strides forward in our denim offering, including the wonderfully titled Slim Distressed Boyfriend, which refers to the jeans on the left-hand side rather than the bloke on the right. But the denim range is both on trend and getting ever more sophisticated. If that was trading, this is expansion. 500,000 square feet of new retail selling space. Major selling space increase in both the Netherlands and in Germany. So four stores in the Netherlands in the period, taking us to 11. So we went from 7 to 11, big increase in the Netherlands. And then large stores in Germany, in Dresden, Krefeld, and Stuttgart, all open in the period. We also opened on Rue Neuve in Brussels. That's a smaller store, 19,000 square feet, and has been a spectacular success. It's only the second store in Belgium. And in the period, we also commissioned the increased warehouse space in both Spain and Tarika and in Mönchengladbach in Germany. Some pictures of some of these new stores. Venlo, Rotterdam, Arnhem, and The Hague. These are Dutch ones, clearly built to last. And then in Germany, Dresden, the first store in the old east of that country, Krefeld, and Stuttgart. We've slightly altered the presentation of the selling space expansion. I hope we've brought a little bit more clarity and insight as a consequence. Ordered by selling space at the end of the most current period, so UK, Spain, second, Republic of Ireland, and then Germany creeping up on the Republic of Ireland in square footage. I think two important things, maybe three, to bring out, and this is year on year rather than half on the previous half, so it's the first half 15 on the first half in 14. First, the increased number of stores, 269 to 287, and the increase in square footage from 9.5 million or so to 10.5 million or so. The second point to make is the rate of increase in Germany and Netherlands. I bring that out now because it's part of important part of the like-for-like story that I'll move on to in a moment. The last thing to reiterate as we all get excited about the entry into the US is just how much road we still have in front of us in continental Europe. 5 stores in France only, 16 in Germany only, 3 in Austria, 2 in Belgium, and so far, and so on, against 164 in the UK, 40 in Spain, but not a single high street location. The first will be Gran Via in Madrid, which I think will open before Christmas. Right. If you exclude the Netherlands and Germany from the like-for-like calculations, then like-for-like across the rest of the piece was, I think, a more than respectable 3% up. The impact of new store openings, however, in Netherlands and Germany has brought us back to that level figure. It is the normal pattern of Primark expansion in new markets. We saw it in Spain, we saw it in the UK after Littlewoods. Is it unique to Primark? No, but it's a strong characteristic of this particular business, because a good number of people in the early days travel very long distances to shop in awfully crowded stores, particularly at the weekend. And most weekends we find people in Germany who've come at least 200 kilometers to shop. When we open a new store close to their home, they go to that one instead. And what's more, the people in those new areas who wouldn't make the journey before now have a Primark to shop in and a much better trading environment. So we will see these impacts many more times in the future. It's just a stage we go through. We're intensely relaxed about it, just so long as the new stores, as we open them, trade well. Stores just going through some which have been opened in the last year, Alexanderplatz in Berlin, Stuttgart and Cologne, they're all regularly in the top 20 stores in sales performance week by week. So the new stores are great, and this impact of new store openings isn't something that we worry about. Further expansion to come then, in the second half and beyond. We expect to open another 300,000 square feet or so in the second half. New stores in Germany, Belgium and Austria amongst them. Looking perhaps slightly further out, Downtown Crossing is on schedule for an autumn opening, and that really is very exciting. There's an extensive pipeline of new stores. We fully expect some 1.5 million square feet to open in the next financial year, a lot of which will be open by Christmas 2015. And then finally, because we love our supply chains, it's worth mentioning that the new depot in the west of the Czech Republic will open this autumn as well. So to summarize these results, the first half, the cost improvement is still occurring in sugar, and as we look to 2017, that is essential. Lower EU sugar prices dominated the profitability of the group in the first half. Maybe we're seeing, and I hope we're seeing, the turn in the European sugar market. Significant profit increases in both ingredients and agriculture, and grocery further margin improvements again in the first half. Strong Primark sales growth and the launch in the period, very much still on track, and the US launch preparation is well advanced. As we look ahead, the trading outlook for the back half of the year is unchanged. AB Sugar will make profit for the full year, we fully expect. We expect the Primark sales growth and expansion to continue, as we expect the grocery, ingredient, and agricultural improvements to continue. In Primark, the focus is on delivering compelling product, maintaining our cost advantage, whichever market we're in, and offering the lowest prices and best value into the now and forevermore, and we will remain true to that. So with that, let me stop and pass over to you for questions, and I hope from us answers too.
So we'll start with Warren. Your hand went straight up there.
Thanks. I think this is on. A couple of questions. The first one, John, you talked about efforts to mitigate the Primark currency headwinds. Could you elaborate on what those efforts might be? And do you expect Primark's EBIT to be lower in 2016 or 2015 with adverse FX more than offsetting the stepped-up space growth? That's the first question. And then secondly, just on the EPS guidance, I think you snuck in a slight change from marginal to modest decline in the outlook. Could you perhaps give us a bit more colour on that? And then just looking at the consensus for 2016, I think it's 116p of earnings, which would be quite a significant step up from 2015. Given the currency headwinds, where do you expect that to settle? And maybe can you talk about the moving parts for 2016, particularly how much can the other businesses offset the Primark issues and maybe tax? And then just finally, just a small one on the accounting standards on the lease obligations. You said it could be quite a big impact. Could you perhaps give us a ballpark figure for how much net debt might be increased by? Thanks.
Right. Okay. So let me start off. I think this is a difficult time of year to be giving firm guidance on Primark for next year. I'm sure you will understand that. I mean, we haven't set budgets, and so I think it's important that we give you guidance for this financial year, but next financial year, I think it's really direction of travel, which I think is important. So in terms of Primark for next year, Warren, I think it's very important this morning that we give you a feel of the scale, clearly, of the effect of those currency moves. And we know that it isn't just buying in dollars and selling in sterling, but the move against the euro is particularly acute. I mean, it's some 20% or so in terms of the exchange rate movement. So at the moment, what are Primark doing about that? Well, you can imagine that they're looking at every avenue to mitigate the effect of currency. And so it's the degree to which that will be mitigated. Clearly, sourcing is the major area that they're looking at. So I think we've said before that in a number of countries, even though the garments are actually priced in dollars, the cost base of those suppliers are not totally dollar-based. So a forensic look, if you like, at the makeup of the cost of garments, I think, is particularly important. And Primark are looking at that. The other thing that Primark will be looking at is clearly some raw materials, not notably cotton, but then also some of the synthetics that come from crude. They'll also be looking at that. So you can see that there's very much the offset there. But certainly when it comes to the consumer and the consumer experience of Primark, I think George, on that very last slide, has made it very clear what the Primark position will be vis-a-vis the consumer. We are going to look after the Primark concept through this. I think it's worth a reminder, and look, most of the people in this room will remember that, we've seen something like this before. And, we talked very early on about the effect of the near tripling of cotton prices back in 2011. And I think then we talked about the impact on margin. So I think it's for people to model and to come out with a sort of view
of the effect on Primark, and you know it would be wrong of me to give a sort of a very detailed guidance in terms of where that is. But I think clearly, you know, it is compared to where we were 3 or 4 months ago, we are looking at much lower margins for Primark. I'll try and make sure I get the other questions that were in there. Yes, in terms of the effect on this financial year, you're absolutely right to pick up the change in the outlook statement. That change from marginal to modest, in other words, the decline in adjusted EPS is bigger than we thought before. And it's not trading. I think George made very clear in terms of the trading of the businesses, in fact, in a number of them, how robust that trading actually is. We're looking at reflecting particularly the transactional impact of currency on British Sugar, so for the remainder of this year. And I think the very first bit of the autumn-winter range for Primark, just coming into August and September, which you'll be well aware, and so the effects of that will come in there. So, yes, we're looking at a lower EPS for this year by a few percent or so to reflect that, and that's those are the words that are behind it. I think you asked about consensus for EPS for next year. I would expect people to look at their EPS and to reflect, you know, what we are flagging as something that we have to deal with for next year. And then very finally, lease standard. It all depends, I think, and I said, on the methodology, and it's all behind the methodology. So sometimes if I'm honest, I get completely lost in terms of the capitalisation of some of these blessed things. But I think you'd be looking at about 2 billion. And the reason that I've raised that and highlighted it at this stage is that often people say, well, okay, your bank debt is going towards zero. But hang on a minute, you know, economically we've got, you know, these leases which are currently off balance sheet, and you know, the accounting will bring them on balance sheet, but they were always there. So we're saying, you know, when you do look at, you know, the level of external commitments of the group, you should be taking leases into account. Now, clearly, you know, when everybody does the numbers, then you know, the banks, you know, looking at ratings or whatever, they've already taken that into account. But, you know, the accounting will nevertheless be there. OK, thanks. Maybe, is it Richard at the back, isn't it?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, morning. Richard Chamberlain, RBC. Just a couple of questions, please. One on sugar, one on Primark. So on sugar, are you expecting any more restructuring to take place in the second half or into next year? I just wondered if the cost reduction sort of performance improvement initiatives you're talking about will carry on into the next fiscal year as well. And then just going back to this sort of point about Primark dollar sourcing cost mitigation, is it your sort of expectation that, I guess, pricing is going to go up for the industry as a whole? I guess the concern might be that Primark's got fairly sort of short-dated hedges versus a lot of its peers, particularly in the mid-market, so you guys might be forced to raise prices a bit earlier than some of the others. So I just wondered what your sort of general expectations are on pricing going forward. Yeah. Thanks.
On the sugar one to begin with, no, for the foreseeable future, we're done on exceptional costs and restructuring. Those two sugar factories in China, and then the write-down on the Vivergo asset, that's it. Most of the rest of the profit improvement program in sugar, well, it comes from all over the place, but it's not related. It's not contingent on big lumps of write-off or exceptional cost. Primark pricing, I'll repeat what I said before. We will be the best value retailer on the high street when the cost of cotton went up back in 2011, we protected the consumers by taking a hit on our margin. There are 800 new products in Primark every week. So prices, there are always new prices in the business. I think it's worth reiterating a point, though. Within the Primark DNA, prices go down, not up.
Okay, thanks. I mean, I guess just a related question. Are you starting to see sort of fabric pricing coming down a little bit more now to match the material price decreases
some
you're seeing?
Cotton is feeding through, and the artificial fabrics and the blends are coming down.
Okay, thank
you. So some of what John said previously about mitigation, there are areas to go looking for.
Right. Okay, thanks.
Great. Some more questions?
Yep.
Yes. Just at the back.
good morning. Fintan Ryan here from Berenberg. Just have two questions, please. Firstly, on sugar. I get the sense from the presentation that the Chinese sugar market has gotten incrementally more positive. Do you think you can actually get that to an operating profit at some time in the foreseeable future? And also, within the European sugar business, how do you intend to react to the quota abolition in 2017 in terms of sales volumes? You know, some of your competitors, such as Sudzucker, said they expect to increase production by 20%. And then on Primark, just for the space growth guidance for 2016, do you clarify if the 1.5 million square foot includes the US expansion? And how much would that add to that 1.5 million? Thank you.
Sorry, how much?
How much would that add to the 1.5 million?
If I could just answer that latter one first, it was a quicker answer. Yes, it does include the US, and the US is about 500,000 square foot by the end of 2015-16. On sugar, yeah, I've seen all sorts of numbers about who's going to produce what, and I think we have to wait and see. It's interestingly, there are two parties to producing sugar. There's the sugar factory, and then there's the grower. Whether growers will produce enough sugar beet to feed a 20% increase by whichever company it might be, I think we need to wait and see. What are we doing about 2017 arrival? Taking just as much cost out as we can and getting as efficient as we can. We have a very good view not only of the cost curve for manufacturing, but all for processing sugar beet, but also for growing it. And I think there's a very interesting point about where on the cost curve, how much volume, at what point you start to start bidding up the price of beet to get it grown. And I think, what do I believe? In the long run, I don't think that Europe can really, most European producers can survive in a market where more sugar is produced in Europe than the consumer. I could well be wrong, but based on where the world price is now and what we'd have to sell sugar into that world market price at right now, I think some people are going to struggle. The point, of course, of producing more is that you reduce your fixed cost of your fixed overheads. Fixed costs of production, but that is not the only thing that's going on in the total supply chain cost.
And in the Chinese sugar business?
Oh, I beg your pardon, yes. Yeah. Chinese sugar business, yes, I think we can get it to profit. Given the low level of the world market price, we have been pleasantly surprised by the increase in the Chinese sugar market. Because we're surprised by it, we're not confident in it remaining in place. There is a lot of stock in China in government hands. How they deal with that in time will determine the supply of sugar in China more than anything else. The next issue, of course, is how many imports they allow.
Okay. Thank you.
But at the moment, the imports seem to be restricted and the price has gone up as a consequence, and that's great.
Great. Thank you. I think there's a question here. Thank you.
The good news is your goodie bags have just arrived.
Okay. Excellent. Jamie Merriman from Bernstein. My question's also on Primark. I was wondering if you could help us quantify of the 50 basis point reduction in margin from the first half, how much of that was due to the weakness in the autumn versus things that may still annualize, like Spain inventory levels coming back to normal, or something like deleverage from the expansion of the warehouses in Europe?
Okay, the expansion of the warehouse, the deleveraging effect is very small.
Okay.
Almost all of it is in the markdown percentage, and that splits about half and half.
Okay.
Increased markdown of autumn, winter, and then increased markdown in Iberia due to more normal stock levels.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, great. Fraser at the front here.
Good morning, Fraser Ramzan at Nomura. It's a sort of slightly related question. I'm just thinking ahead to FY16. You're opening a lot of space, you've said, before Christmas. Obviously, you've got US entry, you've got the new Czech warehouse. Are you anticipating that on all of that huge program of activity, there would likely be a deleveraging effect across next year as well? Because obviously, currency is one thing to plan in our margins, but we need to think about that very large volume of activity. I completely understand you've not done your budgets yet, but I'm just trying to think about the shape of that extra cost going in. And if I could just also ask, in the first half just gone, obviously your new space was highly, highly productive.
Yes.
Did that therefore have a leveraging effect on your margin, even though it was new space?
Inevitably, a little bit, and it depends on the category, in answer to that last question. The extra cost of opening, which I think is your deleveraging point, I don't think we'll see much. I don't think there'll be any extra opening cost in the States compared with what we've been wearing this year. There might be a little bit of supporting new stores. That will depend very much on how well they open. But there's a fair old cost pre-opening
already going in,
some of which will fall away as we get stores open. And then in the markets where we're opening the rest of the stores, we've already got management teams in place. And there isn't a lot of extra cost to introduce into those markets because of the new space. Now, every store that opens has pre-opening costs and some early week support costs. Mm. But if they open as they have been opening, that is overcome or paid for very quickly.
Yeah, understood. Thank you.
It's worth reminding, Fraser, that this year we're carrying nearly 10 million for pre-opening costs for the US. I think I've given that number before, high single digits. Yeah. Any other questions? Alex. Just the front.
Morning, it's Alex Smith from Investec. A question on the US opening for Primark as we get towards that. I guess I'm interested to know how you as a management team think about the various scenarios of how this might play out yeah. over the coming 12 months. I mean, it feels to me you're opening 8 stores, you're going to trade them for a year.
Yes.
What are the sort of the KPIs we should be keeping an eye on which determines whether or is it quite binary in many respects? Is it a case of you get to the 12 months, it's not working, you pull out, or you get to the end of the 12 months and you flick the switch to full national rollout, or is there some kind of middle ground in between?
I'm just picking up one point you make. This isn't a trial. This is a US market entry in a limited area. And in the absence of complete calamity, we're not about going in and testing the water and pulling back out again. This is, you know, we're going to stay and we're going to learn. And then once we've learned our lessons, then we'll think about expansion. I think there are three potential sort of scenarios. The early stores open hugely successfully, and hope so, but no vast confidence in that. They open without being noticed and no one turns up, and I think that's unlikely too, particularly downtown crossing. Or the one which I think is much more difficult is somewhere in between.
And then we've just got to spend 2 years getting this, getting, and I think it'll be getting the price points and the merchandise right. I think if the first is the case, let's say we have eight stores that open really, really successfully, you then have to ask yourself two questions. The first one, is this a temporary phenomenon? Or is this a sign that you're wanted in all sorts of locations? And then secondly, if you conclude that actually it's not temporary, what do you do next? Well, that's a question, I think, for 2 years down, down the track, if it's all been very successful. If it's been middling success, then I think it's all it's actually internal to those eight stores and how do you build them. And if it's very unsuccessful, then we'll... I don't know. We'll try to get it right.
You spoke about having price leadership on the high street in the UK and Europe. Yeah. I mean, do you think your proposition will be as differentiated in the US as it is in Europe and the UK, or is there just a lot more cheap clothing sloshing
the
around?
The Primark advantage is I think, founded on three, probably even four, although people are sort of more sceptical about the fourth. The first one is the best prices on the high street. The second one is attractive fashion at those very low prices. That, it, we believe, is as differentiated in the States as it is in Europe. The third one is just great locations. And what I mean by great location, well, Alexanderplatz was voted the best new store in retail in Europe last year. These are stunningly different stores to buy cheap clothes in, or value clothes in. And the last one, which we're very interested in the States, it's service excellence. And we think in the States we're differentiated on that too, or we can be if we get the training programs in place and the staff attitudes right. It's not just price. If it was just price, we would be, I don't know, we'd be just another discounter of jeans and sweatshirts, and then we'd have a tough time in the States. It's all the rest of it that makes us so different. And I think that makes us as different in the States as we are at the moment in Europe.
Great. Jamie Norman.
Yeah, morning. Jamie Norman here from SocGen. Two questions. Primark in Germany, would you expect like-for-likes in F16 to be in line with the group average or even better? Partly because, you know, you're looking at a more normal trading pattern. You sort of iron out the 200 kilometres driving factor. But second, also mindful of the new openings in Germany and the sales densities
yes.
that arise from that. Just a sort of steer on what would you expect from Germany after this year of transition, what you'd expect for F16 like-for-likes? Yeah.
I think we'll see impacts of new stores. There are a number of new stores to open in Germany, and that will have an impact again next year. So it'll remain an unusual market. I think there'll be less impact next year. The heaviest impact has been in the Ruhr Valley, where we've opened four stores in quite a tight area. So, no, I don't think it'll look like just any other Primark market with normal rates of new store addition on a percentage-wise. I think it'll be higher.
But I think the two things are related. I mean, Fraser made reference earlier on to the superior productivity of the new stores. I mean, they're part and parcel of the same success story. Mm. You know, these stores are opening with these very, very high sales densities because of the fact that people are travelling to it. Then when you open new stores nearby, and they're a year old or 2 years old, then they're in the like-for-like, and they get affected by the other stores opening. So that's why the like-for-like measure, which I'm perfectly happy for everybody to see, but I think we've got to see this effect within it. I think it will continue.
So it'll continue as long as you have a reasonably aggressive opening programme?
Yes, I think it will.
Sort of dilutive.
I think it will, because you look at some of the sales densities of some of these new stores that have opened over the last year. When they go into the like-for-like and you open some other stores near there, you are going to have some effect on that. I think we've got to recognise that.
Second question, if I may, on British...
You see what I'm trying to do, Jamie? I don't want you to do a rebound. It's what I'm trying to stop you doing.
Okay. Yeah. Second question on British sugar in the context of the reduced price that you're paying to the farmers from, I think, £31 to just under £25. Farming Today last week said that for all that, it is still the most profitable category for farmers. And I just wondered from that whether there might be scope to reduce the price further, or you just take it that you're going to have sort of pretty guaranteed supply of volume looking forward.
I think two answers in two points in answer to that. The first one is UK sugar beet has to be competitive with European sugar beet. And of course, the devaluation of the euro reduces the. I think does put downward pressure on the price of sugar beet in this country. It has to if we're to remain competitive. But the second one is that we are not just. We're competing with other crops, and it's the relative profitability, which I think was the point that Farming Today made, that determines whether UK farmers will grow sugar beet or won't. We are in the early stages of the negotiation of the prices for 16-17, so I'm going to stop there.
Right, I think I saw a hand up over there. Yeah. Yes, Jack Gorman.
Thank you, Jack Gorman from Davy. George, you mentioned earlier on when you outlined the European footprint for Primark that it's very much a case that there's still plenty of growth ahead of you. Can you just give us an outline or your latest thoughts on your space pipeline looking at maybe 2 or 3 years? Yeah. I know in the past you've maybe demonstrated a little bit of frustration at the pace at which you were able to identify and secure locations, especially in the likes of Germany and France. So just wondering if you give us your latest thoughts on that, please.
The space pipeline is looking 2 or 3 years out is strong. In only one market, which is Iberia, are we running into the problem that once you're in half the places you want to be, getting the other half is a bit tougher. So the pipeline is good. Actually, even in Iberia, there is now a little bit more shopping centre redevelopment going on, which of course provides opportunities for a large user of space to get involved at early stages. Of course, because we're such a traffic driver for a shopping centre, we're a very attractive tenant, and we're much better known than we would have been perhaps when some of those frustrations were in place. I think that if there's a last point to make, it is that our property teams are much more extensive across Europe than would have been the case a few years ago, so there's a lot more work going on to secure locations, a lot more capability to do that work than there would have been 3 or 4 years ago.
And is it fair to say, just as a follow-up, that when you look out over the next 2 or 3 years, that it's predominantly in the territories or the countries in which you're already operating within Europe?
Yes, it's all. It's all in those markets. And the uncertainty is the United States.
Right. John, could you just remind us of the comps for Primark for the balance of the year, by quarter, if you've got that? And then just secondly, if you wanted to be half full on Primark, could you say that the real like-for-like is more like +7 if you add back the +3 from Holland and Germany, and then the 4 points from the productivities that when they go into the like for likes, actually, I mean, is that not one way to look at it?
Are you describing me as a half empty person, Warren? I think you may be the first one to. Let me hit the like for like one first. I mean, I think as I've said, I think they're part and parcel of the same feature. So I think George has really clearly shown today that like-for-likes are not about the actual trading of the actual stores themselves, but really are a function of the expansion more than anything else. And I think that was really the most important. What was the first question? It was And what was your...
On the, comps.
Yeah, on comps. Yes, yeah. Very strong in the third quarter of last year. So you remember March and April in particular were very strong. So I think from memory, I think actually March and April were like plus eight last year, and then really softened off pretty well to sort of like zero towards August of last year. So I think, you know, we're up against very strong comparatives in these 2 months. I think it's worth, you know, reminding ourselves of that. And then it does get easier as you get into the later summer. Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for your questions. You notice Sue running up to me with a little note. Well, it's very important for you. It's all about a little bag of goodies, which I don't want you to go without. So Sue tells me that they're waiting for you on the table where your reception badges were when you arrived. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.
Thanks.